Art was on just a couple of weeks ago on one of my podcasts. We talked about the mystery within the mystery about the Roswell witness, how he met who he believed was the son of Melvin Brown, Mike Brown, in his class back in the sixth grade back in 1971. So we're going to do kind of like a three-part series, and we're going to talk about a couple of different things, not just Melvin Brown, but Art has an interest in the Kinross incident. Matter of fact, he's the one that lit the fire under me to find out more about that. And then there's also a man by the name of Donald Kehoe. Donald Kehoe was a UFO researcher. He was a non-believer, and he changed his tune. He's also former military. I think he was Marines. Is that correct, Art? Was he in the Marines?
Yes, he was. Yep.
And so he changed his tune when he started investigating things. And nobody talks about the guy. He's forgotten. Like he doesn't never existed. And yet he uncovered all this stuff and did all this research and always had a, you know, was more than willing to look into and try to find an answer. And not everything he said. Now, I don't know that much about Donald, but didn't he? He also took like a very reasonable approach to these investigations. Not everything was a UFO. Is that correct, Art?
Correct.
So he took a...
He was very well respected out there, Donald Kehoe, and he had a lot of connections with the military at the time.
Yeah, and you look back and you wonder, why does nobody talk about this anymore? You know, there was a time that even the press welcomed that a little bit. Yeah, they denied things, but they still talked about it somewhat openly, and it seems like it's been a blackout where they don't even talk about UFOs. They won't even entertain the idea on any of the major networks. And I really believe that was an order that was put down and said, nope, we're going to avoid it altogether. And if you do put somebody on, make sure to make fun of them. Now, once in a while, there will be some things that will be shown on network TV, and it's surprising, but it seems less and less and less. They pretty much said, these things don't exist. We're not going to talk about them. When I believe they obviously know opposite. Many within the networks know that there is a greater truth, and they're told to be quiet about it. So we're going to talk about those things, and we're going to talk more about Melvin Brown because there's a lot of detail that we didn't get into. And there's a couple things that Art wants to clear up, I think, from our last show. Were you happy with the last show? Were you surprised? Did you enjoy it?
Yes. And for the people out there, it's my first time ever interviewing, so I was a nervous wreck, but it seemed to come over okay.
I think it went great. I think you worried too much, Art. I think you did just fine. And, you know, it's not an exact science, nor should it be. Conversation is conversation. So we are going to talk about, is there anything you want to say to start things off? It's good to have you on board again. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you. And we need like a five-hour show just to scratch the surface of this thing, really.
Yeah, maybe so. You know, maybe someday I'll have one of those, like Coast to Coast, where they do, what, 3 hours? Yeah. So we're going to talk about... The first thing you wanted to talk about was the Kinross incident, just for a little bit, right?
Yes. The Kinross, which I actually discussed with Mike Brown way back then, and I at that time was pretty convinced it was a cover-up. And, I mean, it's amazing that people don't know about it, especially up there in the UP. Isn't it surprising to you that nobody...
I never heard
about it.
Well, again, the media, you think they're going to go around saying, hey, guess what happened? They want you to forget about it. They want people to die off. And I don't know if I even just blame the media. There are others outside of the media that want that to happen. So you can't blame the news people that a year later never heard about it, the story. It's maybe the top heads in the media and then also government, military. So I'm sure it was buried away, just like Flatwoods Monster, which was another huge story, which has been on my program before. So there's tons of them, really. I was watching this program. Did you see that one about the Russian one? How many things there are? This woman who was a former, I don't know if she was a cosmonaut, but she came forward with all the, and she's done all this research. And they've had their own Roswell incident that some consider it, and it happened in the 80s. Have you watched any of that?
I did see that one video that came out on that, yes.
So in every country, it seems like. But let's talk about Kinross, because this is close to my heart, too, because I do live up here. And you just, after learning about Eugene Moncla, who was the pilot, and Robert Wilson, you wonder what happened to them. And you feel bad for their families, because even their families, didn't they put on the gravestone that they didn't believe what they were told by the government?
Well, one of the plaques, I guess, actually mentions that he died with a UFO incident.
Really?
And the thing is, what do you tell the family of something like this? And if I understand it right, they never got back financially anything because they're still, technically, they're still missing. So they never get, the family never got funding on this when they lost their loved ones. But what do you tell them? Holy, they got caught up in a UFO. But by the way, this is everybody's imagination, these UFOs,
yeah.
Right?
It's a Canadian transport plane, which the Canadian government said, no, it wasn't us. So the incident,
even,
go ahead.
Let's go through the bag of goodies, okay? Weather balloon. Well, it's kind of hard to explain the physics on that. Well, it got caught up in a weather balloon, and it kind of just took off, and we never found any trace of it. Temperature inversions on the radar, and you know, because there were several radar systems that caught this, actually caught the UFO and the military jet merging into one object and then disappearing. But these temperature inversions, they're just some type of distortion on the radar system. And that was the explanation for the Washington, D.C. sightings, was it was temperature inversions.
So they used that a lot.
A Canadian plane, that's the only thing that's left you could possibly explain this on. But the only problem there is, not only do you have one plane that has no trace found, now you've got two planes. And yeah, the Canadians totally denied anything with that. So, yeah, it's just so overly convincing, and they're just surprised that people are just unaware of this incident.
Well, you know, nobody reports on it, so people don't find out about it. Most people get their, you know, people are changing. They used to get their news from the networks, and now a lot of people are getting internet, this next generation coming up. And good for them, as long as you don't buy everything you hear on the internet, but at least you're looking at outside sources. But those of you not familiar with the Kinross case, it happened, was it 1953 or 52?
1953.
And Eugene Moncla and Robert Wilson, they were actually from Madison, and they got called up to cover, I don't know if they were covering it or sent up here, to the base in Upper Michigan at Kinross, which is near the Sioux. And there was, I think it was over the Sioux Locks, that they spotted something in that area. And they were concerned because they thought the Russians might be spying on it or could destroy it. It was the Cold War. And so they scrambled the jet. And by the time the jet got up in the air, this thing was already out over Lake Superior. And from there, the story goes, like you were saying, that they watched it on radar, more than one. Any idea how many, Art?
I thought there was three separate radar systems that actually saw this, but a couple of them, they were sworn never to talk about it.
Mm. And so this thing, the UFO remains there, or whatever this thing is, it remains there. But the jet that Moncla and Wilson are in actually seem to be absorbed, or it just becomes one blip on the screen. There's not two separate ones. One's sitting there, one's approaching it. The one that approaches just stops. Now, does it go down in the sea? No wreckage is ever found. Now, you also told me there was another man who investigated this. What was his name?
Yes, I'll mention him right now. John E. L. Tenney. And he's known more in the paranormal research. In fact, he shows up sometimes up in the UP there with the paranormal conference that you guys have up there.
Up in the Sioux, okay.
But anyway, he researched the Kinross incident. He actually got a hold of some FOIA papers. And it was quite interesting because the FOIA papers is something brand new and nobody got a hold of before. And it kind of hinted that there were still conversations going on with at least the one pilot after the images disappeared off the radar.
Hmm.
Which, if you think about it for a while, if anything else, it kind of hints there was no crash. At least there was not a crash because there was still some conversation going on. But what exactly was happening, it's unclear. But very bizarre. But,
so if that is absolutely true, that they still were having conversations while they're inside this ship, how mind-boggling is that?
I don't know, but that's where I'm going with it. It's like, what the heck happened then? But these were some papers he got a hold of, and there's quite a story behind it. I wish he'd write a book, but if you ever catch him at one of these paranormal conferences, ask him. And he did present at the Swamp Gas Conference that we had in Lower Michigan just about a year back. I did talk to him briefly about this on the site, about the Kinross incident. very interesting. But now back to Donald Kehoe. Donald Kehoe wrote a couple books in the 50s on the Kinross incident, and he's the one that really broke it out. And I think it's because he had some contacts out there, and they talked to him about this. So anyway, yeah, so his books, I read one of them, and they came out like in the mid-50s. The incident happened in 53, and the books came out in 55. Well, anyway, there was this Armstrong Circle Theater, which to me is like the biggest moment in UFO cover-up, the finest moment. Armstrong Circle Theater, they had like a 10-year history, and it was involved with a lot of plays and drama, but they did do different things. They did documentaries. But for whatever reason, they decided to do a UFO extravaganza.
Now, is this a TV show, or is this an actual...
This is a TV show from the 50s. It went on for, I think, over 10 years. In fact, I think it jumped networks from NBC to CBS. Very famous TV show back then, but they would touch on different areas. But they decided to do a UFO live show. And they had all the big names on there. Well, anyway, they got the Air Force involved. And the Air Force had to pre-approve everything that was said on the air. And they went through like 2 days of rehearsals. And it just totally... Do you remember Kenneth Arnold, who was...
Yeah, absolutely.
Big name. He got so upset, he didn't even show up for the final show. Because everyone had to pre-approve what they were going to say on the air. Well, Donald Kehoe was one of them, okay? So the Air Force is really nervous about something here. And I think it was the Kinross incident. I think that had something to do with it. But no one ever really kind of proved that. But anyway, when Donald Kehoe, when he started to talk out of hand, his microphone went off. It went completely off. This is live TV in 1958, right? So, and anyway, when I got pictured, you know, there's somebody like behind the scenes, you know, and they said, well, you know, if anyone talks out of hand here, why don't you just push this button or something? Cause that's what it seemed like it happened. So anyway, and there's Long John Nebo, who had a radio show back in the 50s. He's similar to Art Bell, but from the 1950s. He had a show on this where they were all on there, Kenneth Arnold and Donald Kehoe, and they talked about this. And it's a real blast from the past to listen to that. I can give you a link to that because it is on YouTube. Hmm. It's kind of fun to listen to.
Stuff I never even heard of.
Yeah, and I still think Kinross had something to do. I think the Air Force was really worried about that one, and they didn't want Kehoe to get in a lot of detail about that on the air. So, and that was the last time, as far as I know, that the Air Force was ever involved with a UFO TV show. I mean, there's retired people. They'll retire and they'll talk about it, but I don't think anybody representing the Air Force ever was involved with TV again as far as UFOs.
Yeah, I know, you know, I never obviously wasn't alive in the 50s when they were doing that stuff, but, you know, you see clips of how they interacted and made speculations and tried to talk their way through things. Now they don't even take the time to do that. Now they don't, like I say, they pretty much just ignore it, and they figure if they ignore it, the rest of the population is. But I really believe the majority of the population believes that UFOs exist. There's research that says that I think it's over 50%, more than that, that believe that we are being visited. And I'm sure a bigger majority believes, even if we're not being visited, that there is other life out there on other places. How old were you? I'm sorry, let me ask you this. How old were you, Art, when you first started believing that there were UFOs or life on other places?
I think it was around 12 when I started reading the books. And I had a neighbor told me about Donald Kehoe, and he actually told me about the Armstrong Circle Theater because he remembers catching it on TV, and he says, yeah, the microphone went out. So I had to go back and kind of like revisit some of that stuff. But, yeah, I remember my neighbor telling me about that back then.
Don't you think it's interesting how some people will hear about that and they'll go, oh, okay, and they have no interest. And then other people would pick up on it, and they take a really strong interest in wanting to learn more about that. And you've never seen a UFO.
No, I haven't. Well, I'll take that back. I did see something weird once in my 20s, but it wasn't really all that spectacular. It was just a couple satellites that were kind of like heading towards each other, and one kind of stopped for a minute while the other one passed. And I was like, that's kind of weird. But It was way up there. Could have been almost anything. It was nothing really spectacular.
You think satellites can stop, though?
No. it was way in the hell up there.
I'm just saying, you think that they can... How could they stop it? Just, they must be have anti-gravity maybe now, the new invention with satellites. So maybe you did see something. You know, it's so easy to doubt. Even what I saw when I was in third grade, this thing that our whole family witnessed, it had flashing lights, and it seemed oval in shape, and it was huge, and it was on the horizon, and it slowly moved across from north to south over the treetops. And for years afterwards, I didn't know what I believed or not believed with that, but it wasn't like anything else I ever saw because it had several different colors of lights. You know what the standard lights of a plane look like. You know how long it takes a plane to move. And a plane does not have an oval shape. And this thing was huge. And that was one of two craft that I've seen. And so you dismiss it, and which is probably a good thing. It's probably a good thing to dismiss it because you should be a little skeptical. But then sooner or later, you have to start believing. You have to go back and say, wait a second. Something's not right. So now that you tell me these satellites stopped, I'm thinking...
Well, yeah.
I'm thinking it wasn't a satellite all those years.
I'm a bigger skeptic than I am a believer on most of this. And I'll be honest with you, 95% of the UFOs you could just throw away anyway. I mean, I'm tired of seeing videos of blurry objects. It could be almost anything, yeah. A plane or whatever.
And I agree.
The majority of the UFO sightings is that, you know, so... Yeah, it turns a lot of people off. Like, there's nothing to it. But something like this Kinross incident, there's no explanation. There's, and the way they acted on the Armstrong Circle Theater just kind of convinces me all the more that, you know, there's something to this.
You know, there are a lot of people that share stories that are really remarkable, but they don't get made public. And I just think there's probably millions. I'll tell you a story about, I don't know if I ever told you this one. My mother-in-law, she won't admit this. She will not admit it to this day publicly, but she did to me because I gained her trust. But she witnessed, her and her sister witnessed a craft land. Now, this is back in the 60s. So it was an oval craft. It landed, and they freaked out, and they went and told their husbands, and their husbands made fun of them, said they were drinking, and they weren't, and said they were drinking, and they were afraid to talk about it ever again. And it's these kind of people that are really good witnesses, two people that saw something that is not anything that the government back then had, and they saw it land. And how many of those stories go unreported? Because it just takes one time when somebody makes a joke out of it or whatever, and after that, they clam up. They clam up. A lot of that is lost.
Yeah, there's a lot of stories out there. I like to hear the ones from the pilots, and I like to hear the ones from the people that ran the radar. Those are the most interesting. There's a lot of stuff going on. Really hard to describe.
There's so many different things. And I tend to trust people if they're not seeking attention. And you have to make a judgment call with everything. And after a while, you kind of get a feeling for maybe who's telling the truth. The thing is, I truly believe they exist. How could they not? How could we be alone in the universe? What are they up to? That's a bigger question. And you can talk to many different people on that. I know we don't want to spend too much time. Anything else you want to say about Donald Kehoe? Just a remarkable guy. He deserves to be remembered. He's a pioneer, wasn't he?
Yeah, most certainly. And he was a member of the NICAP, which is the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, which was similar to MUFON, today's MUFON. Yeah, very respected guy out there.
Hmm.
So anyway, Roswell.
So now going back to Melvin Brown. Melvin, as we were talking, you know, you kind of concluded and you pieced together over a number of years, a lot of information about Melvin, because you're trying to prove in your mind this kid that you met was the son of Melvin Brown. And you met the two British daughters who later told you, no, we were never in the United States. But then they go on and talk about their father being Melvin Brown, being at Roswell, being a cook. Well, how many other Melvin Browns are there that were in 1947 a cook at Roswell? And you didn't actually meet and find out the name of Mike Brown. Did he ever tell you the name of his dad? No, right?
No.
So you just put two and two together. This is Mike Brown. His dad was at Roswell. He was a cook. He had two British daughters. Why are they denying all this? Why is Mike acting really weird, like he's going to be left behind? And, you know, the natural conclusion was that, well, he maybe Dad, being in the Air Force and being stationed at other locations, you know, Melbourne, maybe he had an affair. And that's where Mike Brown comes into this story, and that's why he didn't return back to England when they left. Am I accurate on all that so far as your speculation on that?
Yeah, and all the years of curiosity, it builds up. When you have that many years of curiosity on something, it really builds up to something. And I finally, I contacted the researchers, and I finally made contact with Beverly Brown. And through mail, I sent her a couple letters, and she finally left me a phone message, and she was absolutely furious. She just got completely out of shape that I would suggest that that she had a brother, and she's never been abroad anywhere. She's never been to the United States, and her mom had a nervous breakdown over this, and she comes in. So her phone message to convince me all the more to get to the bottom of this thing. I mean, really research this and find out everything I can. And, you know, I was looking for Mike Brown for years in England, and I thought something happened to him. I really did. And I remember you and I were talking about that, and I sensed maybe a vibe or something, and that kind of drove me, too. And I thought it was Mike Brown. I thought something happened to him, and I was to try to prove, you know, something. And
right. We joked around about it a little bit, but you thought he was buried in the backyard. You thought
well,
he was...
I thought something happened.
Because
to him,
didn't he make it sound like he wasn't going to go to England and he may not be alive? Didn't you say something like that to me?
Well, you know, he shocked me. He says, unless they bury me along the way. And then that's so planted in my memory. I'm thinking, okay, well, something happened to him, you know? Yeah, it was shocking when he came and said goodbye and he was moving to England, unless they bury me along the way. I mean,
wow. Who
I,
says
my
that?
Memory of that so.
And he was really upset. He was really upset.
He was teary-eyed. He was shaking, too. I mean, it was just shaking. It was like nervous or something. It was weird, okay? It was very weird. The whole experience was weird. But try to, you know, your listeners out there, try to understand from my perspective, I'm extremely curious. And call it obsessed if you want. Okay, I can take it. You know, I'm an obsessed nut over this, but I want to get to the bottom of this, and I really researched Melvin Brown, and I did find out a lot about him, which I'm going to have to probably come back for another show or two to really go into detail. But when I just touched on this last time, you kind of said, well, you know, some listeners are going to think I'm obsessed, and it's like, yeah. I'm just touching on it. Wait till I really get into this. I mean, there's a lot to research someone, and there's a lot to get somebody's military records and all that. So, and I'll go into that. But yeah, she was upset. So that I started them to go through the interviews. And some of them are on YouTube. And by the way, somebody asked me about when they were first on their first interview, when Ada was crying, and she says, well, Melvin's always been, you know, Melvin says he was always faithful to her, and then they go into the Roswell stuff, and I mentioned on the last show how odd that was. Somebody thought that was on the YouTube videos. It is not. It's one of the first interviews they made, and it was done in London. I've never seen it, but Donald Schmidt talked about this on one of the talk shows.
Hmm.
And I recorded that because I thought that was extremely odd.
So you never really saw the interview, but it was an interview they did in London, and they come out and say that, you know, you're thinking they're going to talk about Roswell, but something about, was this on his deathbed that Melvin
yes.
said to his wife, you know, I've always been loyal to you? Is there something like that?
Always been faithful to you.
Okay. And then he goes
on. Before anything mentioned about Roswell. So I'm hearing this now, and then when I go through the reviews, the interviews, and I'm seeing, you know, number one, they emphasize so much that Melvin never returned to the United States. After he was in the United States in the early 50s, he never came back to the United States. And they emphasize that on that so much. It's almost like they're answering my questions before I ever ask them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, so to me, it's extremely odd. Well, not only do they do that, they come up with this bank account story, and I don't know if you know about the bank account story.
I think you told me a little bit about that, but I really know nothing, because, I mean, the only stuff I know about Melvin is through you. But what was that about?
Well, supposedly on their deathbed, on Melvin's deathbed, they're talking to them, and all of a sudden he gives the numbers to this bank account in New Mexico. And oh, there's money there. I kept a secret from Uncle Sam. There's money in that account. Well, okay, so when he passed away, they made calls to the United States, and they tried to trace down that bank account. And they show a paper on the interview, and it has four signatures and dates on it, and it says it has the number of the bank. And to me, it looks kind of hokey, but it's to represent the bank account. But anyway, the researchers, when I contacted Donald Schmidt on this, he told me they never could find a trace of that bank account. Like it never existed.
Like it never existed.
Well, what I think, I mean, because they emphasize so much on Melvin not returning to the United States, and now this bank account that, of course, he left in the United States, he just left it there dormant. I mean, to me, it's a stage prop. I almost think it's like they're just trying to push over that, oh, Melvin never returned to the United States.
Now, did his military records prove that he came back, or did he come back?
No, see, there's a problem there. I was hoping when I got his military record that I would, it would show Michigan and all that. But no, it shows that he retired from the Air Force in 1964.
And where was he stationed at that point?
Chick-Sands, which is one of the bases they will never discuss. They never mention Chick-Sands, and they never mention Scotland.
Where is Chick-Sands?
Now, Scotland was... It's in England, and I don't know if I can tell you geographically exactly.
That's okay.
Where
I was just curious what country it's in. Okay. So
it's in Upper England, and I know Kirk Newton, Scotland, was the other base he was stationed at, which, by the way, that's where Mike says he was born at. That's about 3 hours from this Hemel Hempstead. Hemel Hempstead is the only town that they ever mentioned during their interviews. It's the only town. Beverly says she was born there. And Harriet, she doesn't say where she's born, but I know that she was born in Scotland. So Hemel Hempstead's the only town they reference in all their interviews. And there's a story that Ada met Melvin at a dance in 1948 at this Bovington Airfield. So I researched this Bovington Airfield. And they, at one time during World War II, they actually had United States Air Force and British Air Force together there during World War II. But after World War II, the United States Air Force was no longer allowed at that base until later years. She's saying that he was stationed there in 1948. It's impossible. There was no United States Air Force at that base at that time.
Hmm.
And so these things like this, it just seemed kind of odd to me. I think that maybe they're avoiding naming some bases, and that might be why she kind of made up this story. But Melvin was stationed there later, in later years, after they got married. And that was something else I wanted to tell you. I want to correct. They got married in 1951. They came to the United States in 1952 and 1953. And that's when the oldest daughter was born, and then they returned to England. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, this Bovington, I really researched that for quite a while, and there's no way. And also, Melvin never laid a foot on British soil until like a year later. So, I mean, people can be off some years. I already was going over this, but I just. The whole interview thing to me just seems kind of odd, and it seems like they're dodging things. And so I have a lot of FOIA requests. Some of them are still pending out there, and I'm trying to trace down if Melvin had residence in the United States in later years, which I think he did, obviously. And I'm also trying to trace down their travels, because when you do international travel, it does become public record.
Mm, yeah.
It's a matter of digging those up. It's a matter of digging it up. Oh, and here's the other thing I got to tell you. Okay, when I did my presentation, it was on a Monday. I can tell you that for sure.
And you're talking about the presentation of the UFO story you did in school. The report. Okay. So this was back in 1971.
When I did, okay, I was scheduled to do it on a Friday. I remember this, and we ran out of time. So I presented first thing Monday morning, because I remember it was a long weekend to remember that, you know, to go through that. So I know it was on a Monday, and I know it was early May. Well, guess what? Beverly was, her birthday is on May 3rd. And her 13th birthday was on May 3rd, 1971, the same day that I think I gave my presentation. Which, to me, it convinces me all the more, but it's one of those things you really can't exactly prove to anybody else. You know, that's...
She was born... Anyway. Do you know her record? You're saying that her birth record proves, or she's admitted, that that's her birth date?
Her birth date, yes. She turned 13 on May 3rd, 1971, and that is the day I believe I gave my presentation.
And you were told shortly after that by Mike that it was her birthday or something.
Well, all he said was she turned 13. I didn't know it was that day or around that time.
Oh, okay. But what was, do you remember what he said? Can you kind of exactly remember? Was it she just turned 13 or?
Something like that. She just turned 13. And then I told him I was going to be turning 13 soon also. It was near my birthday, so that's another reason why I know it was early May when it was a month left of school. So all this lines up. Well, anyway, some people are going to probably say, well, do I have the right Beverly? Well, on her birth certificate, it has Melvin Brown's military number, service number, which I have, by the way. And that's something to tell you, too. Service number, he was first in the Army, and then he was in the Air Force. And his service number is AF and then 7 digits. But anyway, that's how they recognize United States Air Force people in England, as their military number actually shows up on the birth certificate, which is kind of odd. So with all this, I started to dig more into this, and one thing I did do was I contacted the cemeteries in England. I wanted to find out Melvin's middle name, because that would also helped me find his military records. And nobody knew what his middle name is. I don't even know now if anybody knows what his middle name is. But anyway, I know what it is. It's Elmore. And I found where he was buried. So then from there, I got a full name, I got a birth date, and I have a death date. And then from there, I had somebody over there research, go back to newspapers, and I got his obituary. And by the way, his obituary came out the very same day that he was buried at the cemetery. So the guy didn't have at least a public funeral. I'm sure he had a private thing, but he had no public funeral. So anyway, with this information, when people pass away, you can get records. Some you're limited on what you can get unless you're a family member. But I was able to get his military assignments that way.
And go ahead.
I'll go in more detail on this later.
Okay.
But just looking at the timing on this.
So what you were able to uncover was basically who this man was, where he served, the different bases he was on, right? All of that information.
Yeah.
What he was involved with. He was basically a cook at every one of these locations that he served in?
Most of them, he was a cook. He was food service manager on a few cases. So he always dealt with the food. He always dealt
with
the food.
Did he achieve a certain rank at all, do you know?
No. I'm trying to think of what the rank was. But not just the cook was his he was a sergeant.
Okay, so he did work his way up to becoming a sergeant in all the years. And he was in the military for how many years?
25 years altogether, wow. If you include Army and Air Force together.
Wow, 25 years. So when you, if that was him, the man you met in 1971, he would have been out of the military.
He was no longer officially in the military. So I've been trying to figure out what he was doing. Was he doing civilian work or what? And it's been difficult to track that down. Anyway, he started in the Army in 1939. And by the way, his Army military assignments, I could not find. They claim that those were probably lost in the fire.
Hmm.
There was different records that got lost in various fires through the years. But his Air Force I have, and I'll have to come back for another show probably to go in a lot of detail on that. And there's a lot of area to cover on that. One thing I wanted to say, though, the first thing I got a hold of was on Ancestry.com, and I described this to you before. It wasn't really a military record as far as a graphical file. It was just a text. And it was the first thing, but the San Pedro, which was something that Mike and Beverly mentioned, I saw that and it kind of caught my eye. Anyway, that ends up to be his enlistment into Army Air Corps. And it was in 1945.
So you have
Army Air Corps.
I'm sorry. You have another.
The Air Corps was the.
You have another hit on something you remember from a childhood memory, because I remember you said, were there certain things they said, and then they say, here, San Pedro, you remember that, and it actually turns out to be Melvin Brown. You had no idea, but that was a place he was at when you were able to research that later. And here, the daughter says she denies that they were ever here, but yet here's another Melvin Brown, if there's more than one, that was in the same location.
Correct. Now, when they named all these towns to me, I don't believe they lived there, but I believe there were places that Melvin was stationed at. And he was stationed at San Pedro in 1945. Now, the only thing with me, anyways, I'm going through all these files, Melvin Brown files, and I zero in on just that one because it's something from memory, what they told me. That ends up being correct. Now, the only author out there that really had a lot of information on Melvin Brown was Timothy Good. He's a British researcher, and he's the one that I believe the family first talked to. And if you go through the interviews, they had the goods. They had Melvin. First off, they knew Melvin Brown was in the Roswell yearbook, so they knew he was there. But they gave him a copy of a special pass during the actual Roswell event, some special card pass that Melvin had. And then there was something with a food delivery. Well, anyway, another thing they had was the discharge, his discharge from the Army. And that ends up to be the day before the enlistment that I found for the Army Air Corps. So in other words, that all lines up. That cross-references just, and they both have San Pedro on their on the record. That was the place, Fort MacArthur, where he was stationed. So that was his enlistment place and also his discharge place from the Army. So, yeah, I mean, all these things from memory. But, again, what I'm really after, what I'm really trying to prove is if Melvin was in the United States in later years, proof of his residence here, and the other is to try to prove that they traveled here, that Beverly and Harriet and Ada traveled here to the United States in 1971, May 3rd, 1971. So I have a lot of FOIA requests out there, but it's just, I may need help on how to get to those records because some people really know how to get to those type of records. I'd like to prove this.
So Art, why do you feel the need to prove this? Is that to prove to yourself that you really did meet a man who was stationed at Roswell? Or you just feel like because you were being lied to that you wanted to find out more, or it's a fascinating tale? I mean, what drives you to want to find answers for this?
I think all the above. And even then, okay, so if he was here afterwards, I mean, was this bank account just made up?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, researchers could never find a trace of that bank account. They couldn't find anything.
It still may have existed, possibly. I mean, but or like you say,
it could have. I know there's a lot of doormat bank accounts out there. In fact, you can get on the internet and look them up. People that just leave bank accounts.
This has been something that you've researched for how many years now, Art? Did you say?
Well, you know, part-time here and there, but quite a few years, since 2006.
That's when you really became aware of this. That was actually, what was the incident that happened in 2006 that got you to kind of move forward in that? That's that when you had contact with the gals or what?
No, actually, it was a time where I had more time to think about this. You know, my career, my family, everything was kind of settled, and I had more time to think about it. And it's like, I really wanted to get to the bottom of this.
Mm.
And with Beverly's phone message to me and with going over those interviews, and it really kind of drawn me in. It's like, I want to get to the bottom of this. And I think I want to know what Melvin was doing in town. That's the one that really got me bugged. It's like, okay, what was he doing in Michigan?
So it's not even so much the Roswell part of it as it is, what the heck was he doing there? What was Mike Brown? It's the mystery within the mystery is what really intrigues you, because here you got to know this child for just a short period of time. And it was this one of the strangest things you ever witnessed, right?
Correct. And well, to begin with, I was just trying to find Mike. And I think that kind of drew me in more too, because I just wanted to find Mike and make contact with him and see how he's doing. But in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, something happened to him. But as I got more into this, it just kind of drawn me in more.
Mm. And so you pretty much turned over a lot of stones, didn't you? You really, especially in investigating Melvin Brown, you really thoroughly looked through all these records. And anybody that's a UFO enthusiast, and I don't know how many people listening to my show, they may recognize the name Melvin Brown. And you've uncovered some documents that weren't easy to get, I'm guessing. You had some documents that not everybody has access to.
Well, because of the steps I went through. Now, I don't know, you know, somebody else may have copies of this. As far as I know, though, I've never seen them anywhere. Maybe I got them by accident. Maybe I wasn't supposed to get a copy of them, but I did.
Hmm. And it tells you proof. What kind of proof does it show then, as far as these documents are concerned?
Well, I know a lot of people always question if Melvin Brown was just a cook, and these records show that he was just a cook. So that's one thing. The different bases he was stationed at. I know the researchers were guessing on where he was stationed in England, and they were wrong. I know a few discussions I had with them anyway. They were just guessing on where he might have been stationed in England. That wasn't correct. So, if anything else, the bases establish at least a history of Melvin. It's factual. It's on record. It's factual. This is where he was at. So. That alone makes it worth it, because otherwise it's an unknown. I mean, people skeptical on this, skeptical on that, and was Melvin just a cook, or did he do more? But it shows right on record he was just a cook and food manager.
And it shows that he was there, and it shows that you may have met the individual that is referred to and known as, fairly well known as, especially in the UFO circles. He's pretty well known, isn't he?
He's one of the key witnesses.
Really? Considered one of the key witnesses? Even though he never really talked about it, but it was his daughters that talked about it, right?
Right, but I know in the earlier stuff, I mean, the real early stuff, he wasn't known, but later on. But I still think he's one of the key witnesses. But it's hard to say, because I know they got hundreds of witnesses. And like we talked about, Jesse Marcel and his son, I mean, those are big ones.
Mm-hmm. But did you know about the daughters? I want to go down this road a little bit. The video that they did, and they did how many videos? Any idea how many videos?
I have no idea, because the only ones, the ones that are available are on YouTube. Now, I have pieces of interviews on like General Roswell documentaries. I can't think of the names offhand, but just about any documentary on Roswell after like maybe 95 will have something of them. They'll be talking briefly on there about Melvin.
And during those interviews, they revealed that he was a cook and that he witnessed not just picking up wreckage, but also bodies as well. That's pretty much what they mainly covered in those interviews?
Yes, pretty much that.
Was there any other detail that I'm leaving out?
Well, you know, it's funny you say that, because on one of the interviews on YouTube, they mentioned that the uncle, one of their uncles, was told that more details about the craft that was on an angle in the sand. And I always wonder who that uncle was, and I'm curious if that's Melvin's twin brother, but they don't say exactly who that was. So there's other details.
What is his twin brother's name?
Marvin. His twin brother was Marvin. I caught that on the census. I looked up. He came from a big family, and came from a farm and a big family. Melvin. He was brothers and sister, and nobody's ever talked to anyone else from that family that I'm aware of.
Hmm. You think they would have? Because you would imagine he shared this with, well, obviously with his family, his wife and kids. And he must have shared it with other people, you know, that were close within immediate members of the family, brothers, sisters.
I know, but this detail, yeah, this detail about this uncle with the craft makes me think that maybe Melvin might have went in more detail with them than they did with his wife and kids, because they sure don't go into a whole lot of detail. Hmm. It's very limited, and they say that Melvin only talked about this a couple times.
Hmm.
Wasn't talked about that much. And I'm surprised, because I would think that that's something that he would really want to, you know, go in a lot of detail about.
You know, that's probably something that one would think with human behavior, just as we are as beings, that he probably had to open up to somebody, because it would eat you up. It would. I mean, you must have had things in your life that you absolutely had to share with somebody, even if you felt that you had to remain quiet about them. You ever happened to you, Art?
Yeah, most certainly.
And so, I look at it that way myself. It's like, yeah, we're told, oh, don't tell anybody, don't tell anybody. But you got to tell someone, you know, whether it's your wife or a family member or somebody that thinks like you. If we don't release that, it's going to eat us up inside. Now, how old was Melvin when he passed away? Do you know?
His twin brother, Marvin Brown, passed away in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I can find out about him. He was a service guy also. They both went into service about the same time, but they went their separate ways.
So, but do you know how old Melvin was when he passed away? 70s?
Yeah, 69, I believe. 69. He passed away in 86, yeah.
Okay. So, and everything lines up with that he was 69. Does that line up as the guy that you would have, in 1971, would that be about the right age, that at the member, as you remember seeing this individual?
That's about the only thing I can reference on that, was he was about the right age, because he was roughly my dad's age. My dad was in his 50s at that time, mid-50s, I think.
Okay.
But, yeah, I kind of thought that over, too. So he was about the right age.
Interesting. That's something that you will continue to look at, I guess, and always try to find more information on, because this is something that has bitten you, and you're going, what the heck's the answer for this? And, you know, I guess we all probably face mysteries in life that a lot of us will just kind of give up on it. But you didn't want to give up on this. You wanted to keep pursuing it. And, if anybody knows anything that can help Art, without a respect for the family as well, we're not here to bury them, but that can piece this together, that you would certainly appreciate, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I'm after one thing only. I'm after the truth. I want to know what the truth is. That's all I'm really after, actually. And I mean, I was raised where, you know, you tell the truth and you let the chips fall where they fall.
Yeah, but I can also understand where some people maybe want to keep that a family secret to themselves, you know. And you just want to know if this is the same family that you met, basically. That you met back in 1971, right?
Yeah.
And it certainly appears that way. It certainly appears that the two daughters, what are the odds of having a Melvin Brown with two British daughters show up in Alpena, Michigan, a guy that was at Roswell. I mean, there's a lot of coincidences there. If there's, let's just say these are all coincidences. How many do you think there are that line up? How many coincidences?
Not too many when I look at all the details, the birthday and everything else that lines up as well. But I still can't figure out what the heck he's doing in town. What was Melvin Brown doing in town?
Well, I mean, you speculate. What do you speculate he was doing in town?
I don't know. It's weird. Maybe he was doing some type of civilian work. Maybe he was involved with the food service at the Air National Guard base. I don't know. But I could never find anybody that could remember him.
So you know that he was there. I mean, his son, was he there to pick up his son? Was he there to mix his son with his family? I mean, was the son already there, part of the family?
Yeah, correct. And even Mike, I'd like to know what the real history is. If all this is true, you know, when should he come to the United States? You know, it's just, I don't know, still got a mystery to it.
Oh, yeah.
When I get in more detail on the next one with Melvin's records, there's a lot of mystery to that, too, which we'll talk about, including the hospital that he was at.
So he spent a little time, almost like, I wonder if all the soldiers that were there had witnessed what they did, had to go to a different, to a hospital, you know, or some place to detox or to defragment or to whatever it was that they felt that these guys witnessed that they had to cleanse themselves. That's almost what it seems like, right?
I wonder if they were all and maybe it was some type of therapy to push them to keep all this secret. Maybe it was something just on that. But where he was at was behavioral therapy was what the initials stood for at the Texas hospital.
Well, it's a fascinating story, and I'm sure there's much more that we can talk about regarding that. Is there anything else you want to add? Because we're just about out of time for our second show. Is there anything else you want to add about this?
No, I think we're all set. But on this last one, we'll go in a whole lot of detail about Melvin's records, which I'm still researching, by the way. I'm still investigating some things on there. But we'll cover some of it. It'll be pretty interesting, I think.
All right. Well, I look forward to doing this again. We'll talk again soon on this.
Excellent. Thanks, TJ. Pleasure talking.